Parents be warned, this message may contain content which is unsuitable for younger listeners. Your discretion is advised.
This week we will be studying Judges chapter 19. If you've been following along chronologically, you may have noticed that we've skipped six chapters. Those chapters tell the story of Samson. Samson was the last judge, excluding Samuel, who had his own book. And so chronologically, Samson should come last. For that reason, we're holding off on him for now, and instead we'll be spending the next few weeks on the war with Benjamin described in chapters 19 through 21. When exactly the war with Benjamin took place is unclear. We're discussing it here toward the end because it is placed at the end of the book, but before Samson, since he's the chronological end. I fear, though, that I may have done you a disservice by holding out on this story for so long. The war with Benjamin actually occurred relatively early in Israel's history. We know this because according to verse 28 of today's chapter, Phinehas was still alive and ministering in the tabernacle. He was the son of Eleazar, and Eleazar was the son of Aaron. That would mean that he's only three generations removed from Moses' time. And so this story likely occurred in or close to the rule of Othniel, whom we discussed back on September 6th of 2020. So, I really probably should have discussed this story arc some 3 months ago. You'll have to forgive me for overlooking that verse about Phinehas while I was doing my planning. And the story we've got in these chapters is a real doozy. It is one of my favorites because it has so much intrigue. It is full of ethical gray, unexpected twists, and extraordinary events. In the book of Judges, which is full of irony and stories about a wild era, there is surely none more convoluted than this one. It truly fits the book's theme, that in a time when there was no king in Israel, everyone did what was right in his own eyes. We will be considering the story in three parts. First, in chapter 19, the crime of Gibeah, which started all of the fuss. Second, in chapter 20, the war which resulted from Gibeah's crime. And third, in chapter 21, the unlikely results of the war for its survivors. So this week we will consider chapter 19. It is the story of a Levite and his concubine, and a crime committed against that concubine, which brings to mind all of the horrible acts of Sodom and Gomorrah. If you haven't yet read chapter 19, I recommend that you pause and read it now. The story begins with but a single sin, that a concubine, belonging to a Levite in Ephraim, walked out on her husband. Now, if you are unfamiliar, a concubine was basically just a wife of lower stature, likely a second wife. For more on concubinage, you could listen to our message, Rebecca's Lineage, Incest, Concubines, which was published way back when we read Genesis, and that's in chapter 22, verses 20 through 24. Now, as a wife, it was this woman's duty to submit to her husband. She failed to do that duty, however, and instead she ran away from him. And from this one error will spring a highly unlikely and unfortunate series of events. The concubine went south to her home territory of Judah, where she stayed with her father in Bethlehem. She stayed there for about 4 months. Perhaps when she first left, her husband didn't follow her because he expected her to return. But after waiting a while, I suppose that he realized she wouldn't be back unless he went to find her. So eventually this Levite went looking for his wife, taking along a few donkeys and his servant. His father's house would have been a likely place to find her, so it is no surprise that he went there. Or maybe the father had even notified the Levite that she was with him, because when the Levite arrived, the concubine's father was very glad that he had come. Now, the Levite had traveled at least 20 miles, maybe as many as 50. Travel was much slower and more difficult in those days. To travel that far would have taken probably a couple of days at least. And so it is no surprise that the Levite decided to stay in Bethlehem with the father for a few days to rest up. Eventually, though, it came time to leave, but for whatever reason, the girl's father wanted them all to stay. They would get up in the morning, ready to leave, and then he would convince them to have a big breakfast and sit for a while before going. And then they would decide to go, and he would convince them that they had already stayed too long and that they wouldn't get to where they were going, so they needed to just eat dinner and stay for the night. So they did. The father tried this ploy again the next day. They stuck around for breakfast, And then it appears that they waited through the hottest part of the day, and then, when it started to cool, the father implored them to stick around for dinner, stay another night, rather than setting out with so little daylight left. But this time they wouldn't go for it. They decided to get a few miles of travel in and stay the night somewhere. It was a big mistake, but they couldn't have known it then. They started traveling north, back in the direction of Ephraim, and they made good time. As the sun was falling, they came near to the city of Jebus, which would later be called Jerusalem, some 5 to 10 miles north of Bethlehem. As the day was nearing an end, the servant suggested that they should stop there for the night, but the Levite refused on the grounds that he did not want to stay among foreigners. You will recall that Israel was unable to conquer the Jebusites during the days of Joshua, so they had retained the city of Jebus, despite the fact that it was in the middle of Israel's territory, and they would continue to live there for a few more generations until David finally conquered them. Sadly, failing to stay at Jebus was yet another big mistake, which they could not have known to avoid. No doubt the Levite wanted to stay with the Israelites because there was an expectation of safety. The Israelites had a certain standard of conduct that the Jebusites did not have, and our weary travelers would have expected better treatment from their own countrymen than from potentially hostile foreigners regardless. Ironically, that was not to be the case. They likely would have been safer among the pagans than among their own people, sad to say. But our travelers passed on to Gibeah in the territory of Benjamin, a few more miles north. By the time they got there, it was dark. They had no choice but to stop, and when they went into town, no one took them in. They ended up making preparations to sleep in the town square for the night. Of note, this is contrary to the cultural norms of the time. Travel was difficult, and so people did much less traveling then than they do today, but sometimes people did have to travel. The economy had not developed to the point of building inns where travelers could stay, and even if it had, there likely weren't enough people passing through any one place in a night that such a business would be financially viable. So in ancient cultures, it was not uncommon for a person to take a traveler in for the night, despite the fact that they were a stranger. And in fact, it would be somewhat rude not to do so. Today, a person would generally be afraid to do such a thing because of the risks involved. Evidently, people were generally of such a character at that time that they could be trusted to do no harm to those who were kind enough to let them in. Unfortunately, not so now. But they were prepared for an uncomfortable night in the square when an Ephraimite, who happened to be staying in Gibeah, found them, and he invited them in. We note that the travelers were very vocal about being able to provide for themselves. Evidently, they had been begging for a place to stay, such that they thought they needed to demonstrate that they would be no hassle. They also mentioned that they were on their way to the house of the Lord. Now, we have no mention of that elsewhere in the story. It is possible, though, that the tabernacle was near to where they were going, maybe at Shiloh, and as a Levite, that would be a natural destination for him. However, I think he mentioned this in hopes that he would convince someone that he was of good character. So he's really selling himself here. It's obvious that no one wants to take them in and that they've been pushing themselves to get in. This must have been a very inhospitable town. And perhaps the Ephraimite knows that as well. He seems eager not to have these people stay in the square, even if it means providing for them anything they need. We begin to get the impression that the people of Gibeah may not be very good people. But having been taken into the house, the Levite, his concubine, and his servant no doubt thought they were safe. They started eating and drinking and making merry, but it was not long until their fortunes changed. The men of the town showed up, evidently all of them, beating on the door and demanding that the Levite be brought out to them. Why? So that they could know him. And that, I think we are safe to presume, is to know him in the carnal sense, a euphemism for sodomy. Of course, we all know where the word sodomy comes from. It comes from the city of Sodom, the city on the plains, which was destroyed way back in Genesis 19, and which has ever since been the emblem of God's fiery wrath. The men there had intended to commit this same abomination, bringing on themselves a due penalty. We discussed that passage back on August 7th of 2016 in a message titled Sodom and Gomorrah. And if you were to go back and read that passage or listen to that message, you would find a very clear comparison between that story and this one. In that story, a couple of visitors were visiting the square of the city. They were invited in by a non-native of that city, and while in his house, the men of the city surrounded them, making the same demand. And the similarities don't stop there. In today's story, the owner of the house went out to try and reason with the men. In fact, he was so insistent that they not abuse the man in this way that he offered to bring out his virgin daughter instead. And I must say, I would prefer to die than to hand over my virgin daughter to a gang of homosexual ruffians. The fact that this man was willing to make that offer demonstrates just how seriously he must have hated the crime of homosexual sodomy. He also offered up the concubine. So we have an example here that both adultery with another person's wife and the gang rape of a person's daughter would be preferable, at least in their minds, to the unspeakable crime of homosexuality. And that's really saying something, because in previous messages we have contemplated that the law treats adultery as being worse even than murder. And we note here again that the offer the Ephraimite was making is an echo of Lot, who also offered up his virgin daughters to the men of Sodom. In both cases, the offer was not enough for the attackers. It is here, though, that the stories diverge. In Sodom, the visiting travelers were angels, and they used supernatural powers to blind the men of the city. They then made their escape while fire rained down to destroy the wicked people there. No such luck in Gibeah. The Levite had no supernatural powers, and so in a desperate bid to protect himself, he forced the concubine to go out to the men. That, in my mind, seems a bit cowardly. I personally would have fought to the death defending my wife, but for better or worse, this is what happened. Originally, the men had said that they would not accept this, but when the option became available, they took it. Thankfully, the virgin daughter was spared at least. But the concubine was not so lucky. The men both knew her and abused her all through the night, and savagely so, such that when morning came, there was nothing left of her. She fell down dead at the door of the house. What a tragedy. A human life so full of value and promise completely destroyed for the sake of a night's pleasure. And all of the pleasure going to the brutes who deserve pleasure least. The Levite went out of the house and found her there. Presuming she was sleeping, he ordered her to get up and come on, but when she did not answer, he knew that she was dead. He loaded her up onto the donkey and took her back home. I do not think that we can rightly miss the obvious connection here to Sodom and Gomorrah. It is clear that the author of this story intended for us to see the similarity. That story would have been one which was well known to the original audience, and I think the implications are also clear. We have a clear reminder here that the sin committed by the men of this story was of the worst sort, and thus was deserving of the worst sort of punishment. There is no indication that the men went so far as to actually commit homosexual sodomy in this instance, but clearly they were willing to and attempted to do so, and likely this was something they had done before. And adultery, which they did commit, carried the same penalty as that crime. Death. The city of Sodom had demonstrated that God hates these sexual sins, and that where they go unpunished, they will eventually raise a stench to his nostrils, and he will himself respond with destruction by fire. And the corporate nature of the event, that this was all the men of the city and not just a few, indicates that the entire city deserves the penalty. The reader ought also to be shocked by the crime. This is not something which was done in Israel. This is something which had been done by the worst of the Canaanites in the days of Sodom, before Israel arrived. Israel was to be a people set apart, and the Canaanites in generations prior had been cursed to total destruction. To see Israel behaving as badly as the people whom God destroyed before them is truly shocking. So the reader is meant to understand implicitly that the acts committed by the men of Gibeah were the worst sort of crimes, deserving of the worst of punishments, total destruction by any means necessary. But this was a new era. God would not be doing the destroying. Instead, he had called on his people to do it for him. And living in a time when there was no king to enforce such rules, it fell to every man of the country to rise up and do justice. And the Levite intended to spur people to action, so he sent a message that could not be ignored. He cut the concubine's body into 12 pieces, and, presumably giving those pieces to messengers, he sent the pieces throughout the land of Israel. We suppose one piece went to the leadership of each tribe, or perhaps made a tour around each tribe. And that, I'm sure, gave everyone a start. It's hard to ignore a human body part showing up in the mail. Frankly, I think most modern listeners would be surprised that the Levite had the stomach to cut the woman in pieces in the first place. We would do well to remember, though, that this was an agrarian society. They didn't have industrialized food production, so just about anyone who ate meat, would have the tools, skills, and fortitude to butcher an animal. Butchering a human, I think, would be a step above that, but a smaller step to take than the leap an ordinary modern person would have to make. We might also consider that this was a people accustomed to regular war, and war at the time was conducted by hacking one another to pieces with swords, so it's no surprise that they were not quite so sensitive as we are. And so the pieces went through Israel, both drawing attention to the crime and also showing a significant piece of evidence that it had occurred. And so the people saw it and heard the story, and when they heard the story, they were shocked. Homosexuality, gang rape, adultery, and murder were not common among God's people, and were particularly not common all in the same event from the same town. And so when the people saw it, they said that no such similar thing had ever happened in Israel. If only we could say the same for America today. Now, I don't know of any case with exactly these circumstances, but gang activity and sexual sins and murder have become common enough that they are hardly newsworthy anymore. Regardless, the Levites' plan worked in that the people were stirred to action, and so they came together and spoke about it, contemplating what should be done. That's where the story will stop for now. God willing, we will contemplate their response next week and the results of their actions in the week following. To conclude then, Judges 19 kicks off one of the Bible's most surprising tales. This one is full of twists and turns and unexpected events. The story started simply with a Levite whose concubine had strayed. He followed her to Bethlehem to bring her back. When they were delayed in returning, they ended up stopping in the wrong town for the night. That town was Gibeah in Benjamin, and it was the wrong town because of the character of its people. And I must note, the character of the people in a place usually is the defining characteristic of whether or not the place is good. The people of Gibeah demonstrated themselves to be just as bad as Sodom, which God had long ago destroyed. In the end, they raped and killed the concubine. The Levite demanded justice by sending her dismembered body throughout the land. And next week, when we study Judges 20, we will find that this unfortunate conflict will suck the entire nation of Israel in, with some pretty wild outcomes. I hope that you'll be back to listen then.
For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.